expressed, as far as I'm concerned. So thank you. Now, where to go? Let's start with some email. Okay? I had a couple that I wanted to get to. I heard today from our buddy Phil from Sydney. And Phil is in the chat room from time to time. And you all know him. And Phil dropped me a note today saying, Bob, I was wondering and hoping that today, March 25th, you might make a special mention on your show about Greece. Today is Greece's special Independence Day. This is the day it finally rid itself of its Muslim Ottoman occupiers after 400 years of subjugation. All over the world, the vast diaspora of Greece are celebrating by way of marches. Even at my children's primary school, there were big celebrations in the form of singing, dancing, and food stalls. It was charming to see children of all races, including little Chinese kids, getting involved. As for poor Greece, these days it is much beleaguered. It made the tragic mistake of entering into that corrupt and filthy organization called the European Union. I witnessed an explosion in the cost of living, with most people not benefiting from such a union. Greece was laid siege to by the modern-day Ottomans in the form of Goldman Sachs, where its resources were looted, and the poor populace were left holding the bag. In the aftermath, the fault was laid at the feet of ordinary Greeks, who were considered somewhat lazy and corrupt. The so-called European allies were awaiting the remaining blood cleanse. Some German MPs even mockingly said that Greece should consider selling some of its islands or even converting the Parthenon into a casino. Says Phil, to hell with them. In the wings are the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, who have their minds set on sucking the marrow dry out of Greece's bones, who salivate at the thought of turning Greece into a third world nation. To hell with them. Corrupt Greek politicians are saying that Greece needs to implement austerity measures and that the belts need to be tightened so hard they will sever the body in two. To hell with them. Is this how they treat an ancient country and culture which has given the world so much, including a little thing that everyone keeps uttering called democracy? To hell with them. If the financial crisis is not enough, the country has become flooded by illegal immigrants, most of whom originate or gain access through the old enemy, Turkey. They are hostile to Greece and have no intention of integrating, but rather forming ghettos. I even saw on a photo of an Afghan man spitting on the Greek flag in Greece, probably because he felt offended, as there is a shape of a cross on the flag's design. Greece can be spared accusations of religious bigotry, as they suffered hard under Islamic tyranny. No one wants them. There's not enough work. Yet the EU masters in Brussels dictate to Greece that they have to stay. To hell with them as well. I feel like it's some sort of conspiracy to push the final nail in the coffin and finish off one of the world's oldest cultures. To hell with all those blood-sucking leeches. So on this day of celebration, says Phil, spare a thought for poor little old Greece, who survived countless invasions and occupations, but somehow might not make it through this one. Greece has been much on my mind of late, and as I've said on a couple of occasions, I have not done justice to what is happening in Greece by any stretch of the imagination, and I should have. You know, one of the hallmarks of this show has always been the fact that we look for things that are a little bit off the beaten path and outside the mainstream of news that the rest of America usually gets. And sometimes I do, I admit, get sucked into the issues of the day, and that has certainly been the case with healthcare. But I will also say, in my own defense and the defense of the callers to the program, that healthcare has been and will remain critically important to this country. Because until the United States takes care of its own, we will be hard-pressed to reach out when others need us as well, as we have done so admirably in the past, the rebuilding of Europe, the rebuilding of Asia after the Second World War. But what is happening in Greece is a tragedy. And you know what a romantic I am, and by romantic I mean, you know, not the sort of romantic, you know, ooh, Fabio, rip my bodice. No, not cheap pulpy paperback romance. No. No, but a romantic in the sense of, well, Lord Byron. Lord Byron, one of the great romance poets who ran off to fight for Greek independence in the 19th century, and did, I believe, die there. The romance of yearning ever to travel and to see these places that from the time I was tiny was taught are the very acme of what it means to be civilized. How many times on this program, and just in a couple of nights ago, I referenced the value and meaning of catharsis. We don't even have the word catharsis without the ancient Greek culture that gave it to us. We have no concepts of tragedy or comedy or of how storytelling even works without the ancient Greeks. So, my apologies. And I understand the passion that Phil brings to bear very well. It's the passion of a person who loves a place and grieves from afar as he sees it being looted. You know, I remember back before the September 11th, 2001 attacks, I remember the outrage that I felt when I learned that the fundamentalist fiends, enemies of all that is civilized, the Taliban in Afghanistan, had blown to smithereens a World Heritage site known as the Bamiyan Buddhas. Carved out of the living rock, these Buddhas were, and surrounded by caves that were inhabited by Buddhist monks, hermits, ascetics. But because they represented because the Buddhas were a representation of the human form, the wild-eyed fanatic fundamentalists of the Taliban blew them to dust because their invisible cloud friend says you can't do that. I can't begin to describe the rage I felt, the horror. You know, Phil mentions the Parthenon. Unless I'm mistaken, the Parthenon stood relatively unmolested over time until it finally exploded because it was being used as a munitions dump to store gunpowder and a shell hit it or some such. That's when the Parthenon finally lost its roof. That didn't happen in the 11th century. That happened only post-Marco Polo, post-Western civilization. Everything, even the iconography of the Christian church, owes all to ancient Greece. There is a reason that the representations that most of us recognize as Jesus, you know, the sort of honey blonde-haired fellow with the blue eyes and the closely cropped beard, that guy, there's a reason he looks the way he looks. He is an overlay. He is Phoebus Apollo 2.1 from the arts of the ancients. There's a reason that God Almighty in our representations looks as he does. He is a Semitic overlay onto Olympian Zeus, and the sculpture by Phidias that was housed in the temple designed by Praxiteles, I think. Yeah. Whew! You have no idea how far back in otherwise weakened and semi-debilitated brain cells I have to go to come up with that stuff. I'm in love with it. I'm in love with it all. I've been doing a bunch of reading lately on the mysteries that still remain and surround ancient Crete. Another of those cultures that inhabit the Mediterranean. You know, I would love nothing better than to go and live for a couple of years on Crete and eat that Mediterranean diet, watch about 100 pounds of ugly fat slip away, my cholesterol go right through the floor, and, you know, go down to the shore and eat the occasional little bit of the uni. Oh, yeah. I don't know. Learn to pluck away on a bouzouki, perhaps, or some such. And wander among the ruins. God, how I'd love to do that. I can't begin to describe it. To go and see Thermopylae, where literally Western civilization was arguably saved from a Persian invasion, it was pretty much the last time the Persians got froggy. To go to Marathon, to stand at Sunion Head and look off into what the Greeks called the wine dark sea. Oh, how I'd love it. But as it stands, I think I must largely content myself with going there in my head. And to what degree, to whatever degree that I engage in prayer, pray that these magic remnants of our first stuttering steps toward full humanity can somehow remain on the planet. So, Phil, yes, yes, I do mark March the 25th, and I thank you very much for raising it to my attention. And anybody who wants to sort of work over or expand upon the economic nightmare that has been foisted upon Greece is welcome to do so, more than welcome to do so. So that's just a starting place. Other starting places, well, I mentioned that I have not been spending the time that I need to be spending doing world radio travel, as it were. And Phil mentioned the fact that ancient Greece is frequently noted as having given us as its greatest gift. Frankly, I would debate that because I love theater and I love representational art and I love the gift of the grape. And I love fine olive oil, and I love, well, you know. But democracy. Democracy. Demokratia. Demoskratia. People something. And we, in turn, here in the 21st century, in about 5 centuries since the notion was come up with, have decided that democracy is something that is often best delivered at the muzzle of a gun. I continue to disagree. Even the ancient Greeks learned, the Athenians, and we say the Greeks, but it was the Athenians who did the democracy thing. They even learned, at the great cost of their own empire, all of it, and even the Athenians' own freedom, that one is best not to try to deliver demoskratia at the point of a spear, or in our case, the muzzle of a gun. But we do worry about democracy, and we do maintain certain fictions that if we can just get something that we can reasonably call democracy in some far-off, underdeveloped country, that we can call democracy without snickering up our sleeves very much, that we have somehow accomplished something. And so it was that once upon a time, George W. Bush, the man who in the video, if you haven't seen it yet, I'm sure you will at some point, the man who in the video recently, Garrett mentioned this on the program last night. I've seen the video. Agnes saw the video. She said, Bob, play that back. I played it back. She said, Bob, play that again. Bob, that can't be happening. Well, yes, dear, it can. And it did. George Bush sort of shaking hands with a Haitian and then wiping the black person stuff off on Bill Clinton's sleeve. Jesus. But one of George Bush's great buddies for his invasion of the Middle East, or, well, Central Asia, one of his great buddies was President Kurmanbek Bakiyev, president of Kyrgyzstan. Too many consonants, not enough vowels. Kyrgyzstan. President Kurmanbek Bakiyev has told a national congress that, he just doesn't see Western-style democracy working in Kyrgyzstan. And he says democracy's run its course there. We've had too much of this freedom business. People just saying what they want to say whenever they want to say it. It's not worth it. No, President Kurmanbek Bakiyev says that he envisions something that he calls consultative democracy, where there are dialogues with influential social groups, and that would be more in keeping with his country's traditions of boiling political opponents alive, because he does that. There's only one problem. Just one little problem. We're sort of busy with a little chunk of Kyrgyzstan. We have these air bases there. And we use the air bases to go bomb brown people. But President Kurmanbek Bakiyev recently said, encourages society, which based on community life and responsibility, it seems that it is not easy to become accustomed to a Western system of human rights. Yeah, those Western human rights. Which Western human rights? We seem largely to have given up many of them. And yeah, granted, I think the Obama administration is working toward maybe restoring some of them and regaining some of that high ground that George W. Bush and Darth W. Cheney, the big time Richard B. big time Dick Cheney, ran, you know, that high ground, high human rights, they ran off it, ran. We're trying to get some of it back. But Western style human rights aren't working in Kyrgyzstan. Because those people that thought they were going to get them some democracy since we had an air base there, they propelled Bakiyev to power in 2005 in a popular uprising. And then President Bakiyev promptly screwed down the thumb screws real tight on anything resembling political opposition. See, you really can't have democracy without political opposition. And you have to have a commitment to the idea that we're going to work things out verbally as opposed to manually or chemically via the gas-charged explosions of gunpowder. President Bakiyev is concerned about democracy because he thinks it's been, it's been a little deleterious to the Kyrgyz society, and he's very much disturbed, and wants to review the concept of individual human rights. He says individual human rights lead to selfishness, and a decline in public morality. Jesus, he sounds like a Republican. Louis Gohmert, anybody, Republican, Texas, wants to take away the ability of the American people to vote for their U.S. senators? I think you could sit those two down to high tea and they'd get along famously. There was a protest rally planned, but near where Bakiyev was speaking about his misgivings about democracy. They were going to have a protest rally, but instead the police came and rounded up about 20 people, and, well, no rally. No democracy. Akshumkar, opposition party leader, that's the name of the opposition party, the name of the leader is Timir Sariyev. Well, Timir Sariyev said the detention of his supporters was a gross violation of the Constitution. The authorities are afraid to hear the truth and learn what truly concerns normal people. You know, food, shelter, heat in the winter. Oh, and you're going to love this paragraph. This is the final paragraph of the news story from the Associated Press. Most Kyrgyz people rely on state-controlled broadcasters as their main source of news, but those stations have failed to cover a series of protests against rising costs for heating and electricity. Most American people rely on corporate-controlled broadcasters as their main source of news, but those stations have failed to cover a series of violent acts against American politicians. Several media outlets that cover Kyrgyzstan have seemingly fallen victim to a coordinated media blackout over the past 2 weeks, including a handful of prominent Central Asia-focused news sites, which have been inaccessible to Kyrgyz internet users since March 10th. Meanwhile, just in case you were wondering, Western countries view continued stability as essential in Kyrgyzstan, which hosts a U.S. airbase serving as a supply and transit point for operations in Afghanistan. Yeah, that's going just fine. No slowdown. The planes are still landing and taking off right on time, so to hell with Kyrgyz democracy. Right. But I did mention a moment ago that it does appear that the Bush administration is trying to get back on the human rights path. And I say that sincerely. You may recall that the Vice President of the United States, a man by the name of Joe Biden, took a little visit to Israel not too long back, where he was treated like crap. Publicly humiliated. Oh, it made me so mad I could have chewed nails and spit rivets. Well, then it came out that the Israelis were using dummied-up passports, British passports, Australian passports, and that there's even video footage of Mossad agents who were using these dummied-up passports in Dubai slipping into an elevator where they went up and promptly, summarily executed a Hamas leader. You know, sort of telling the whole wide world, you know, we'll do what we want. What are you going to do about it? You know, the last I checked, the Israelis and the British didn't take too kindly to that. But again, Israel says, what are you going to do about it? Well, you know what? Bless his heart, this is one of those moments where I'm so doggone proud of Barack Obama. Just want to give him a big old hug. The wild-eyed, half-crazed, right-wing, walking freak, who is the Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, came to the United States to visit with Barack Obama. And didn't work out so well. Well, I am proud of Barack Obama for this. He came to the White House, Netanyahu did. You know, cleaned all the blood off his hands first. And they were to discuss the current settlements being built in East Jerusalem, which are, again, a direct slap in the face at the peace process that the U.S. and the Obama administration has so tirelessly worked on. And, you know, Netanyahu said, well, you know, these aren't really settlements because our capital is Jerusalem, and it's not a settlement if it's in Jerusalem. And when I read that quote, I thought of something that a school teacher of mine once taught me or once told me about in elementary school. Down near where I grew up, I believe it was a family of Jacksons, not Andrew, but some Jacksons, and they had a mansion. You know, this is the Old South, antebellum, slavery, plantation, the works. And, do please bring me a mint julep, would you? You know? And it was a magnificent huge spread, and the mansion was beautiful. It burned only when I was a child. Lightning struck it. And the columns were all that remained, and they used to stand sentinel on a hillside or on a hilltop, and they were absolutely eerie in the moonlight. But one of my teachers told me that it had been the philosophy of the guy who owned that plantation. He said, I don't want to own all the land. I just want to own the land that is next to the land that I own. Now, for even a fifth or a sixth grader to sort of go down that road and figure out, wait a minute, there's always going to be some land next to the land you own, no matter how much land you buy. Ding! Early toaster for little Bob. So all Benjamin Netanyahu has to do is say, wow, you know, it's part of East Jerusalem. And we're going to build some more settlements. And the next thing you know, there's East Jerusalem settlements. Never mind Jordan. East Jerusalem settlements in flipping Baghdad. You know, because, well, we're just settling East Jerusalem. That's all we're doing. But anyway, Benjamin Netanyahu showed up at the White House. And there were meetings between Netanyahu and President Obama. But you know what? Obama did not come out and pose for photographs with Mr. Netanyahu. To say the very least, that is a rarity. I mean, come on. The president of Kyrgyzstan shows up, gets a picture with the president, you know. And then President Obama looked at Prime Minister Netanyahu and says, well, Benny, time for dinner. I'm going to dinner with my family. You're free to stay and do whatever you want to do. If you make any progress, call me. I'll come a-running. I'm going to dinner. Did not invite Netanyahu to dinner. Did not put on a state dinner for Netanyahu. This is big. This is very big. And so when he left him, he told Netanyahu he could consult with advisors and let me know if there's anything new. This according to an unnamed U.S. congressman who spoke to the prime minister. The congressman, unnamed, said, it was awful. Another Israeli newspaper said that the meeting was a hazing in stages, and implied that it was poisoned by such mistrust that the Israeli delegation eventually left rather than risk being eavesdropped on a White House phone line. No, really? The Israelis were afraid of being spied on by the U.S.? How's it feel? Another member of the Israeli delegation complained that Netanyahu had been given, quote, the treatment reserved for the president of Equatorial Guinea. Racism much, Mr. Delegation Member? So Netanyahu and his cadre retired to the Roosevelt Room. He did get another half hour with President Obama a little bit later. Stayed an extra day for some emergency talks. But eventually wound up leaving. Last night? And neither side issued an official statement. Things aren't even going well for Mr. Netanyahu back home. Because, you see, the only support he has is from the hardline, the hardliners who would just as soon kill every Palestinian and get the job done quick. The news story that I'm looking at, which our buddy Joe Ray, the Foxhole Atheist, sent along, comes from the Times Online. Naturally, this is not American press. They're not allowed to print this kind of stuff. Sources said that Mr. Netanyahu failed to impress Mr. Obama with a flow chart. I brought some charts! Purporting to show that he was not to be responsible for the timing of announcements of new settlement projects in East Jerusalem. Yeah, okay. The article also says that Israeli media is calling Netanyahu's visit a White House ambush, for which Netanyahu himself is largely to blame. So as the article continues, the Likud leader now has to square the demands of the Obama administration with his nationalist, ultra-Orthodox coalition partners who want him to stand up to Washington, even though Israel desperately needs U.S. backing in confronting the looming threat of a nuclear Iran, which parenthetically exists only in the paranoid imaginations of right-wingers. Haaretz, the Israeli daily newspaper, said the prime minister leaves America disgraced, isolated, and altogether weaker than when he came. You know, isn't it interesting that the Israeli press is harder on the Israeli government than the American press is? Mr. Obama, talking about him going to dinner, Mr. Obama suggested that Mr. Netanyahu and his staff stay on at the White House to consider his proposals so that if he changed his mind, he could inform the president right away. Quote, I'm still around. The Yediot Aharonot daily quoted Mr. Obama saying, let me know if there is anything new. Not so much. So, you know, I gotta give a little, you know, it's coming up on spring. We'll be playing golf soon. A little golf clap to President Obama for having the nerve to stand up to a thug like Benjamin Netanyahu. Proud of him. Proud of him. So there's that. Okay, we've done the international news. I don't mean that flippantly. But no matter how I want to, there's no running away from some of this stuff. We have talked about this at some length over the last several days, and I don't believe it is fair for us to stop talking about it simply because it's becoming rather tiresome and more than a little bit frightening. When last we spoke, we were talking about the Bricks Through Windows campaign and the lard-ass Alabamian militia man who is encouraging people and basically is the birth of that conspiracy to do property damage, terrorism, if you will. We talked about the death threats that had been delivered via telephone to Representative Louise Slaughter. We talked about the note on the brick in one of the offices that said, extremism in defense of liberty is no vice, the old Barry Goldwater quote. We talked about the fact that some teabagger, some birther, deather, tenther, booger eater teabagger had cut the gas lines at Representative Tom Perriello's brother's home. Well, it didn't stop. It isn't over. And it isn't going to stop. It turns out that Representative Russ Carnahan, Mel Carnahan's son, Representative Russ Carnahan, as a result of his vote on health care and health insurance reform, had a coffin placed near his home. The Politico report that I'm looking at says the coffin was from a prayer vigil, and protesters say that the coffin symbolized babies who would be aborted due to the health care law and was not a threat to Carnahan. Yeah, okay, well, at least 10 Democrats have felt the necessity of getting beefed up security because of the threats against them. Some congressional Democrats have even gone so far as to phone their spouses back in the home district and say, go stay in a hotel outside the district until some of this settles down and until I'm home from Washington, D.C. These freaks may try to hurt you. All the threats that have come out have caused the FBI to hold a closed-door briefing for Democratic members of the House and Senate. Also, Capitol Police and the House Sergeant-at-Arms were involved. God, I despise these baggers. They said it was from a vigil where they used the coffin to represent all the babies that were going to die. When in fact there aren't any babies that are going to die because of this altogether less than comprehensive attempt to reform our incredibly shattered into a million pieces healthcare system in this country. I wonder what would have happened if someone had showed up at their vigil with another coffin to represent the 45,000 Americans who do really die, who are really living human beings who have been born. 45,000 every year because of corporatized, for-profit, failed healthcare systems, health insurance systems. Well, you know, those 45,000 people, they're imaginary. At least if you're a birther, deather, bagger, tenther, booger eater, they're imaginary. So, that's not where it stops, though. No, not by any stretch of the imagination. You know that we have talked over the last couple of nights about this freak from Alabama, this hypertensive, congestive heart failure, diabetic lardass who's living off of his wife and Social Security disability, named Mike Vanderboog. Well, he came crawling out from under the baseboards to have a conversation with Alan Colmes on Alan's radio program. Or maybe television. I don't know. Give it a listen. This is worth the time.
Alan Colmes, welcome to our program, and joining me is Mike Vanderbo of the Pimpson, Alabama, former head of the Alabama Constitutional Militia, who has a... how you doing, Mike? Thank you for coming on.
Oh, I'm doing fine. Haven't had much sleep lately, but you know, sure, why not?
You know, I'm one of those people way over there in the far left, so I don't know if that upsets you.
Oh, I've heard you from time to time. Otherwise, I wouldn't have agreed to go on your show. Yep. You are actually one of the more intellectually honest folks over there.
All right. Well, I think I'm flattered. In any event, let's talk about what.
And if I may correct you, I was not the head of the Alabama Constitutional Militia, as the press has reported. I was a leader in the. In a constitutional militia unit in Alabama. We did not have that name.
Okay, well, thank you for correcting me. That had been reported, as you know, which is where I got that information.
I know from my good friend Judy Thomas and Kansas City Star. I haven't had a chance to correct
you. Okay, thank you for that correction. You have a website that was quoted by John Avalon, and John Avalon of the Daily Beast also quoted you and wrote about you and interviewed you for his book called Wingnuts. And you're quoted today as saying on your website, we can emulate the Sons of Liberty of old. We can break their windows. This land, in this land, you say, there's a local headquarters of Pelosi's party, the Democratic Party. These headquarters invariably have windows. When the Sons of Liberty wanted to express their opposition to the actions of the king's ministers, they would gather in front of the homes and offices of his tax collectors and government officials in Boston and New York and break their windows. You're advocating that people go and break the windows of Democratic Party headquarters and congresspeople. Is that correct?
No. No. Now, you just conflated there, Alan. What I said was exactly what you quoted, which is that people should take, if they wish to send a message that Pelosi could not fail to hear, they should break the windows of local party headquarters.
All right.
I did not call for the destruction of Congress critters. Windows, nor any targeting of any persons whatsoever.
Wait, well, you did say, so if you wish to send a message that Pelosi and her party cannot fail to hear, break their windows. Break them now. Break them and run to break them. Again, break them under cover of night. Break them in broad daylight. Break them in a wait. Arrest in willful principle civil disobedience. Break them with rocks. Break them with slingshots. Break them with baseball bats, but break them.
Sort of literary, ain't it?
Oh, it's... sort of literary, ain't it? I think one could read that to mean you want to break Pelosi's windows, the way you phrase that.
I say Pelosi's party, and I specifically say county and city headquarters. And you cannot make any more of it than that unless you try to.
All right, let's leave it at that then. You want to go and you want people to take rocks and slingshots or whatever and break windows at Democratic Party headquarters in various counties, correct?
You're leaving out the predicate. And the predicate is this tyrannical bill.
You say leaving out the predicate. I don't know what to make of.
No, you cannot leave out the predicate. If you want to know why I did what I did, then look at the bill. The bill insists that every one of us, all of us and all of our children, we are mandated to play or pay. If we refuse to do that, then we will be fined. If we refuse to pay the fine, as things go in federal law enforcement, we will be arrested. And if we resist arrest,
at this point,
naturally go,
I think he's dropped the brown acid.
We will be killed.
Killed?
Wait. You're going to be killed if you resist arrest.
Yeah, for health care. Ironic, isn't it?
Yeah, wait, you're not going to be. No one's going to kill you.
How do you believe that?
Wait a minute. One thing at a time. Before we get back to that, you are saying if you wish to send a message, Pelosi and her party cannot fail to hear, break their windows. So you're saying break the windows of Democratic Party headquarters in various locales.
I hope there's a federal prosecutor listening to this, too.
Predicate, no predicate. That you're telling people to go and break windows to commit acts of vandalism.
Nancy Pelosi just announced that we will do according to their will, or we will be a fined.
That's how laws work.
Killed.
That's how laws work. But you are saying...
Wait. He just said that Nancy Pelosi announced that they would that the people who didn't pay would be fined, arrested, or killed? Now, I haven't read the whole bill. I haven't. I really haven't. But you know what? I got a brand spanking new $5 bill that or killed or arrested isn't in there. It's not. At all. In fact, as has been reported, there are some opt-out provisions in the bill itself that takes the teeth out of this this lawsuit that was filed by the, 13 birther bagger, tenther deather booger eater attorneys general, including the goober in Nebraska who says, Americans have never been forced by the government to purchase anything. Yeah, you know, despite that whole 1789 act that required every American male citizen to go out and purchase a rifle and ball, sufficient amounts of shots or cartridges, and go, but I guess they didn't research that part. But anyway, let's go back, just for the fun of it, let's go back to Mike Vanderbooger for a minute.
Is there a constitutional basis for this?
Well, you're changing the subject to your statement.
Exactly,
you're changing
subject,
the subject, sir.
Do you understand why I don't have wing nuts on this program? The truth ain't in 'em, as Juanita has so often succinctly noted. This guy can't deal with the fact that he called. For, in fact, he originated a conspiracy to do physical damage to private property. And how ironic is that insofar as these rightist-leaning anarcho-Randian libertarian types think property, personal property, real property is the absolute apex of ownership, is the absolute apex of the American experience. How ironic is that? But this is why wing nuts are not allowed on this program. Beyond the fact that there are 1,000 hours of wing nut hate for every hour of liberal talk in this entire country, that Mike Vanderbooger, the little run around, the little ring around the rosy, that he's playing, as Alan Colmes runs off into the weeds trying to play Pop Goes the Weasel with him, that is why those sick freaks are not allowed on this program. In case you were ever wondering.
You're telling people to go break windows,
correct?
You are
asking me to explain why we are motivated.
No, he didn't ask you, Mike.
But I am telling you we are motivated to break windows because we feel a deadly threat from the federal government and the orders that the Democrat Party has given us.
Democrat Party?
We'll do this or else.
A law was passed by a representative form of government legally through Congress that you don't agree with, and you're saying go break windows. You're urging people to go and break the law.
Let's talk about democracy. The founders.
Oh, here comes that part from the back references to that Onion piece about man passionate about parts, about constitutional provisions he imagines exist. This ought to be fun.
Democracy, that is majority rule, as much as they despise the king's tyranny, they view democracy unfettered by constitutional restrictions as three wolves and a sheep sitting down to vote on what to eat. All right? Absent constitutional restrictions, the Democrats' ability to win elections is still illegitimate. You know, our politicians, our soldiers, our police, all of our public officials take an oath to the Constitution. They don't take an oath to a party. They don't take an oath to the election results.
And then, sir, if this is
Round and round the mulberry bush, the monkey chased the weasel. You know, with all due respect to Alan, not comparing him to a monkey, but Mike Vanderbooger is most assuredly a weasel. Now, here's where it gets funner and funner. Somewhere in this piece, you will hear, and I don't really care to hear, and I hope you don't either, the verbal jousting between a lard-ass wingnut and Alan Colmes. But somewhere in this interview, Mike Vanderbooger says, may I tell you my personal motive for doing this? Oh, we're going to get motive, too? Are you paying attention, Mr. Froggy Prosecutor? That's what he said. Prosecutors who get froggy need to set up a meeting with him and his lawyer at a neutral location, because otherwise he'll come out with his six guns blazing there in Pinson, Alabama, and take them out, and ain't going to be no more little Wacos. Right? Yeah. Except, in the course of the conversation with Alan Colmes, Mr. Vanderbooger said, May I tell you my personal motive for doing this? I'm trying to save the lives of Nancy Pelosi and every one of these people who do not understand the unintended consequences of their actions. Because they're not paying attention to the million of people across this deepening divide that politics no longer avails them. Yeah, black guy got into office. Politics no longer works. Go figure. We refuse to participate in the system. And we refuse to pay the fines. And we refuse arrest. Now, where do you suppose that's going but 1,000 little Wacos? Yeah, keep your powder dry, Mike, because we know the minute that the feds show up, your pants will be sopping wet. But that's not where it ends. No. So the word went out for the Republicans to come out and say something, anything, to condemn these miserable, disgusting, un-American activities by the baggers, birthers, deathers, tenthers, and assorted sundry booger eaters. Well, you know what? The Democrats can do two things. They can, in one hand, hope that the Republicans will do the right thing, and in the other hand, and see which one fills up first. Guess what? It ain't the hope side. So all these refusals to condemn these sickening attacks go down. Oh, let's see. Among other things, there it is. The spokesman for the National Republican Congressional Committee said while his organization doesn't condone the harassment, it should be pointed out that Representative Perriello and others aren't the real victims. Quote, Central and South Side Virginians are the ones who are going to have to bear the burden of increased taxes. What you're seeing is a frustration among his constituents who believe he's not listening to them. Senator Orrin Hatch and his magic underwear appeared on Greta Van Susteren's show on Fox. She asked Orrin Hatch what his reaction was to the fact that Bart Stupak, a man who calls himself a Democrat and yearns to control women's insides more than just about any even Republican out there, has received death threats saying that they hope he bleeds from his ass, gets cancer, and dies. What is it with these right-wingers and their fascination with the rectum? I don't get it. Rectum almost killed him. Shame on me. Well, how did Hatch respond?
People are upset and really angry, and they're tired of people making promises and not living up to them.
Huh? So Greta Van Facelift, or Susteren, presses a little bit more, and he finally says,
I think people have to quit doing things like that.
Meanwhile, the right wing has been out there saying that this is all made up. And that, lo and behold, it's the people who are doing the violence who are being victimized. Eric Cantor, who apparently didn't have a Britney Spears show to go to at the time, condemned what he called the inappropriate behavior. But he said that the Democrats are fanning these flames. I'm a bit concerned about how it's been handled around here in a public way, because I think it just tends to fan the flames. And so when that got no traction, well, then looky here. Here comes Eric Cantor again. Oh, screw him. I don't even want to hear his stinking voice. So when all of the non-denial denials and the non-condemnation condemnations come out, and they still didn't work, Eric Cantor comes out and says, just recently I've been directly threatened.
A bullet was shot through the window of my campaign office in Richmond this week, and I've received threatening emails. It's reckless to use these incidents as media vehicles for political gain.
There's only one problem. Yes, a bullet did go through the window of Representative Cantor's office in Richmond. But, and see, this is tough for the faith-based party, because they don't care much for it, and states like Texas are doing everything they can to remove it. But there's this little thing called science. And inside science, there's another little sub-science called ballistics. And ballistics is the science of, how shall we put this in a short manner? The science of how things flying through the air hitting other things can be measured as to how fast they did it and where they came from. Ballistics is ballistic missiles, bullets, rocks, slingshots. Thank you, Mike Vanderbugger. Ballistics. It's not all bullets, but it does have applications to bulletry. Is that a word? Bulletry? And lo and behold, there was a bullet. And it was fired through the wind, into the wind. It did go, yes, the window of Representative Eric Cantor's Richmond office. But upon investigating, A, they found the bullet. B, they calculated the angle at which said bullet went through Representative Cantor's window glass. And they also, you know, all these troublesome television shows, CSI, Cold Case, Crime Scene, whatever, CSI, Topeka, you know, they get people thinking about stuff. And it turns out the bullet entered the window going almost straight down. And that while it did pierce the glass, it didn't get past his window blinds. Which kind of means it was sort of, as bullets go, sort of leisurely falling through the air, having been otherwise projected into the air at some other place. You know, geometry, trigonometry, I don't have it. You know, I can't even do math on the fly on this program. But the short answer is that this was not shot at Eric Cantor's window. Even a little bit. Adjust your azimuth. No, sorry. Dumb luck, or dumb bad luck for whoever has to replace the glazing. But no, Eric Cantor's office was not shot at. Next question. How many outlets of for-profit media will report that instead of reporting, and Eric Cantor's office also had a bullet in it? That's, yeah, I didn't think so. So that's the right-wing lunacy report for the evening, I suppose. And it seems appropriate to sort of wrap it all into one little piece. With a note from our buddy, Critic at Large, Reverbo, who sent along what he calls a cavalcade of crazy, special audio edition. You know, you can read Reverbo's thoughts and ponderings and essayings over at headonradionetwork.com. He is a dandy fine writer, and I suggest that you do so and check back often. Ain't Living Long Like This, a cavalcade of crazy, special audio edition. Reverbo notes, ain't living long like this indeed. Some folks ought to be heeding those words. The bottom of the bell curve is dangerously diluted. That's not particularly shocking. What is disgusting is the vile extremism of the Republican Party. Although they are still in the minority and their total political historical confusion is laughable, not to mention completely phony, I agree everybody best keep an eye out. Would anyone view the health care legislation as a classically socialist program? Capitalist, without a doubt. Fascist? Maybe. That's why progressives weren't wild about it. But there is shattered glass on the street, and we do hear the braying of Nazis. No mistaking that. And I'm not aware of anyone applying for asylum in the United States from those socialist hellholes like France, Sweden, or Australia. Are we to imagine that these slobbering shit brains hate anyone who uses any government service, like interstate highways or the fire department, and maybe make the whole U.S. military a private mercenary force? Do they hate their own parents who depend on Medicare and live on Social Security? How are them unemployment checks working out for your family there, Bobby Ray? I guess we should just be used to this colossal level of ignorance anymore, sponsored and presented by these ugly losers in our own government to the whole world's dismay. What a sad commentary on our nation. Well, citizens must assume that unless a 7 days in May scenario is upon us, that the forces of law and order will come down on any revolutionary behavior with vigorous and decisive determination. You look for trouble, son. You'll find it. Straight down the barrel of a lawman's gun. And thus, from her 1978 album, Quarter Moon in a 10-Cent Town, Emmylou Harris and the Hot Band. The lyrics are about a family of dysfunctional rednecks. There's a notion. But the overall theme is appropriate. And it's a damn fine performance. And so, yes, ain't living long like this. Emmylou Harris. And we'll be back right here on America's listener-supported liberal voice, The Horn.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future. The future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
It's Thursday, March 25, 2010.
Lights out this Saturday. Hot summer down under. It's official. Liquid corn is bad for you. Plus,
this is getting so bad, I'm not sure Congress could pass gas at this point.
Fun with sausage making. Climate change legislation in the wake of health care reform.
All of that and much more straight ahead. I'm Brad Friedman of BradBlog.com.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
You connect the dots.
Here are the dots. Now let's connect them.
This is your Green News Report. Today's Green News Report is brought to you by StopDomesticTerror.com. The passage of health insurance reform has once again led to a rapid increase in domestic terrorist threats, this time against Democratic officials. Velvet Revolution has been calling on the DOJ for months to crack down on those who would incite this kind of violence. Please sign on and support VR's important StopDomesticTerror.com campaign today, before it's too late. That's StopDomesticTerror.com. Okay, Des, the week is getting curiouser and curiouser. What do you have for us in the green news headlines today?
It's that time of year again, Earth Hour, when people all around the world turn off their lights for 1 hour in a global call for action on climate change.
Last year, in the single largest mass action in human history, during Earth Hour, people in more than 80 countries switched off their lights for 1 hour to send a powerful message.
Is it just me, or does Earth Hour come earlier and earlier every year?
I think that's you.
Oh, okay.
This year's Earth Hour takes place this Saturday, March 27th at 8:30 p.m. local time, wherever you are. This year's organizers say thousands of cities around the world, from Bangkok to Los Angeles, have signed on to participate. 25 states in the U.S. have become official Earth Hour states. California, for example, will dim lights on landmarks like the state capitol and the Golden Gate Bridge. Again, that's this Saturday, March 27th at 8:30 local time. You can get more information at earthhour.org.
So now that we have Earth Hour, does that mean we don't have Earth Day anymore? It's just been shortened down to an hour?
Oh, no, we do have Earth Day this year. It's the 40th anniversary.
Is it my imagination, or does Earth Day come around earlier and earlier every year?
Oh, that is your imagination.
Oh, okay.
On Tuesday, we reported that winter 2010 was the warmest and driest on record in Canada. Now Australia wants to get in on the act. It's summer in the Southern Hemisphere, and the Australian Bureau of Meteorology announced this week that it is one of the hottest and driest summers on record, especially in the state of Western Australia, with multiple cities setting records for new high temperatures. And just to add a little bit of weird, a few towns at higher altitudes in Australia have reported their first ever summer snowfall 1 week after hitting high temperatures. Marine biologists say the ocean around Australia is also showing signs of changes. Australia's Great Barrier Reef is showing signs of coral bleaching for the first time this year.
Coral bleaching?
Yes, coral bleaching. That's where the ocean warms so much it kills the coral. Mm. High fructose corn syrup has been getting quite a bad reputation in recent years. The cheap sugar substitute made from corn is now used in a surprising multitude of products, not just sodas, but everything from spaghetti sauce to peanuts, and is blamed for the rise in obesity and diabetes in America. And now a new study finds high fructose corn syrup really isn't good for you. Princeton University conducted the first ever direct side-by-side comparison of high fructose corn syrup versus table sugar and found that rats fed high fructose corn syrup gained significantly supposedly more weight than rats that were fed table sugar, even when they had the same calorie intake. The rats also had significantly higher body fat and higher triglyceride levels. The researchers say it's because high fructose corn syrup isn't natural and it's metabolized differently in the body. Did you have something to say?
No, I was just enjoying my high fructose Dr. Pepper and listening. Carry on.
Ford Motor Company said this week it expects to save over $1 million a year just from turning off its computers. Ford announced the launch of a corporation-wide initiative to reduce energy costs by implementing a PC power management system. It's a software program that shuts down computers and office machines overnight and weekends. Ford estimates it will save them over $1.2 million a year through the simple automated act of turning off computers and other devices when not in use.
Amazing. I thought we couldn't conserve our way out of this crisis, according to Dick Cheney.
A legislative update on comprehensive climate and clean energy legislation currently stalled in the Senate. Democratic Senator John Kerry of Massachusetts has been spearheading an effort with independent Joe Lieberman of Connecticut and Republican Lindsey Graham of South Carolina to create a tri-partisan cap-and-trade bill. Some initial provisions in the draft bill have been leaked. Overall, it is similar to the Waxman-Markey bill passed by the House back in June, but it appears to have even greater giveaways to heavy polluters and the fossil fuel industry. The pressure is heavy on Republicans in Congress to halt all legislation, but Graham is getting support from a new corner. The Christian Coalition has launched an ad campaign to defend Senator Graham from attacks in his own state for working with Democrats on climate legislation. Here's some of that ad.
Energy is one of the most important issues we face today. I would like to ask you to call Senator Lindsey Graham and encourage him to keep fighting for our families.
For more on that strange turn of events, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Remember Earth Hour this weekend. Turn out those lights. This has been your Green News Report.
When the lights go down in the city and the sun shines on the bay.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95.
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head-on with Bob Kincaid.
Yeah, just hearing the intro there reminds me, a little shout-out to our buddy B-Rez, the announcer on that intro track. Had a little conversation with B-Rez last night, and good to hear from him. He's an awful good guy. We have entered the second hour of the program, and if you happen to tune in late, this will be a foreshortened version this evening. My beloved Mountaineers are playing basketball, and I'm going to probably knock off about 8 o'clock to catch the game. It will have been about a half hour underway by then. So I hope you'll forgive me. I'll be back tomorrow night, per usual, per regular schedule for Friday on the front porch. It's, you know, this is a one-off. If they actually make it further, if they win this game, the next games are, you know, on the weekend. So no worries. And I beg your indulgence and forgiveness. Let's see. You know the number, by the way, 877-443-2366. That's toll-free, of course. 877, the numeral 4, head on. On your nickel, if you do want to save us the toll charges, it's 304-658-3333. And let's see if we've still got someone on. Nope. Okay. So chime in if you want to. But I thought I saw News Ninja Gene sent this along this story along to me, and it was so doggone inspiring. I thought it just fit right in with the crazy ass gun toting wingnuts. It's my feller Georgians. It's a great time to be a Georgian. Great day for freedom in Georgia. By the way, did you catch Mussolini Caribou Barbie's Facebook page thing where she was calling on America?
Real Americans can't retreat. We must reload.
And so her Facebook page had a map on it with pictures of with little crosshairs over states that had congressmen in them who voted in favor of preventing the needless deaths of 45,000 of our fellow Americans every year. Yeah, crosshairs, really. Not kidding. Crosshairs. So it was, in fact, a great day yesterday to be a Georgian. You know, not the former Soviet satellite state, but the one founded by James Oglethorpe here in the United States of America. The Georgia Senate on Wednesday voted to allow... Jesus. Voted to allow licensed gun owners to bring firearms onto college campuses. Anyway, that would be compi for those of us who are interested in proper good Latin. Bring firearms onto college compi and into, wait, churches and bars. Well, good. And to let them take their weapons with them when dropping off and picking up passengers at airports throughout the state of Georgia. Churches and bars. I'm just sort of rubbing my eyes here to double check it. Yes, yes, because, you know, that's a good idea. Hey, Hank, let's strap on and carry over to the Red Dog Saloon. Have a few and hope we don't get all pissed off because some lily-livered liberal comes in, tries to have it, because then we'll have to kill his ass. He'll be a-threatening us with his liberalism. Oh, I agree, Marvin, I agree. And you know what? Wait till I get there. I just got this lovely new piece. It's a beautiful, beautiful black satin finished. It's not blue steel, it's that black satin, that matte black satin finish firearm. It's a 40 Smith & Wesson semi-automatic. Wait till you see it. It looks so good with my Sunday go to meeting suit. Just matches perfect. I think, you know, I was thinking about getting one of them little Lady Smiths for my wife to tuck into her stocking garter underneath her Sunday go to meeting dress, so we can be properly attired for worshiping the Prince of Peace. Yeah, churches and bars. Senator Mitch Seebaugh, who sponsored SB 308, said the bill clarifies. There's that clarification again. clarifies the firearms carry law for the state's 300,000 gun owners with permits to carry weapons and leaves the decision up to the private property owners whether to exclude people from carrying guns on their property. It passed 41-12 after nearly two whole hours of debate. The airport measure was separate. It passed 43-10. Kind of makes you rethink that whole even when you're going to heaven or hell, you have to change planes in Atlanta thing. I think next time I fly, if I've got changeovers, maybe I'll make sure I'm doing it in Charlotte or Chicago or Wetumpka, Alabama. But I ain't changing planes in no Georgia. And I think about our buddy Mike Malloy. You know, Mike Malloy is armed, and he is for a very good reason. But, you know, this sure takes the starch out of because churches and bars, I guess it was already pre-existing that you could take it into, you know, your favorite Vietnamese pho restaurant like Mike loves. Or watch your back, Mike. Watch your back. You're living among the crazy people. And this comes from a guy who lives in West Virginia. Georgia's laws need to be simple to read and easy to understand, Senator Seball said after the vote. This legislation brings common sense and clarity. Yeah, you know, it's an existential world. It's confusing. And that's what we need is clarity in our handgun legislation. But I wonder if any of the wingnuts understand what Senator Seball means when he says Georgia's laws need to be simple to read and easy to understand. Could that be because your average Georgia gun owner reads on about a third grade level? Seball, Sharpsburg, stressed that the proposal only applies to licensed Georgia gun owners who, he said, are law-abiding citizens and are not responsible for the types of crimes critics fear will accompany the bill. You mean the ones where handguns go off? He said the vote, which had some Democratic support, you know, the ones that ain't communists, showed people are beginning to understand the proposal. Under the measure, it'd still be a crime for a gun owner to bring a weapon to church or a bar if the property owner, church, property owner, God, how are you going to find out? If the property owner had not granted permission. Board of Regents would determine the policy for the state's college campi and has opposed the legislation. Oh, hey, this is so nice. The legislation also removes the 1,000-foot school safety zone clause for licensed carriers, which Seball said was confusing, especially on campi located in downtown Atlanta with murky boundaries. Oh, it can get mighty murky in downtown Atlanta. It can get some murky. Apparently there is one sane member of the state Senate of Georgia, Nan Orok, an Atlanta Democrat, said it's idiotic to allow firearms in churches and bars where inebriated people get into arguments. I don't know if Nan Orok was implying that there are inebriated people getting into arguments in churches, but it's Georgia. And you know what? Let's say you bring your shooting iron to your local Pentecostal Apostolic New Freedom Hard Shell Baptist Herpetological Sanctuary and Place of Worship, and let's say you get your belly full of strychnine and you take to speaking in tongues and somebody gets to prophesying and then you get bit by the snake. How's that open carry law how's that going to work out? Oh, by the way, there's another bill out there, Senate Bill 291, sponsored by Senator David Schaefer, R. Duluth, who also would notify license holders before their weapons permits expire. And would they expire? Really? How liberal. And would prevent the seizure of a licensed weapon during a state of emergency. No more little Wacos. No more free Wacos. No more free Katrinas. You know, you can just see Hank and Marvin down to the local Walmart. Hey, looky here, Marvin. Walmart done cut all their sports coats now to accommodate a gun in the shoulder holster. Man. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Good evening. How are you?
Hey, Jim. How are you?
Well, Bob, there are two places in Georgia you should avoid. One is Hartsfield Airport, and the other is Piedmont Park after dark, okay?
I will take your advice straight to heart.
These people of whom you speak, I think, should attend a huge banquet catered by Hannibal Lecter.
With some Chianti and fava beans?
Mm-hmm. That'd be nice. And even, you know, I think even Glenn Beck and people like that are trying to urge some restraint, because they're saying that all you're doing by all this crazy talk is really making Democrats look better. That's what I've heard today.
Well, I
heard that on Don Imus this morning, of all people. Can you believe that?
On what, Fox Business Network?
Yeah.
Jeepers.
You know, honestly and truly, that man is a real, he's just a real person, isn't he?
In a hat.
I'm just not going to say anything vulgar or ugly. I'm not in the mood for it. I slip over there and hear him going off on people, this, that, and the other, and trying to exercise his own sense of self-importance. And I thought to myself, my God, I would love to buy you for your real value and save what you think you're worth, as I would some of these other idiots that you've been talking about tonight.
Well, we are awash in them. There's no getting around it. And
but, you know, here's the thing. With the influence of people like this, and you couple that with the decaying infrastructure of this country, and what it equals is a third world nation.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we just haven't put up the sign, we can't afford the flashing neon sign that says, the end is near. And this is a matter, Jim, of trying to.
I wish they would devote some of the efforts and some of their prodigy, if they have any, to projects that would help, you know, help people, and would also divert their attentions to, like I say, the improvement of the infrastructure of this country, which is in bad need of repair.
Well, it very definitely is. And you know, there's technical stuff going forward, too. You know, one of the hearings that was canceled yesterday because of Republican shenanigans over that Senate rule had to do with expanding Internet infrastructure. You know, that it really is the mode of communication for the coming century.
Right. Absolutely.
But didn't get to have the hearing because the Republicans were busy pouting.
Well, listen, I want to ask you a quick question. I know this is an abbreviated program. But with this new health bill, what if you are, and I know of a case like this, and it was put to me today, if you are a hairstylist and you're working in a shop and you have to rent your booth and you're self-employed, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way a lot of them do their work. And I don't know how much money they make, but would these people be required to purchase insurance of some type?
There's an income threshold. There are subsidies. There are subsidies in the bill, based on income. And some of this I don't know if it's been worked out, but there's a de minimis level that can be purchased. There are exchanges as well. And in fact, Nancy Pelosi, I think, issued a warning in the last couple of days that the insurance companies had best straighten up and fly right, or they won't be allowed into the exchanges, which would be a huge blow, because that's going to be big, good money for the insurance companies.
Well, that's what they understand.
But say your hairdresser example, income guidelines apply. And among other things, there are various and sundry different poverty levels depending on how much, how many members are in the family and so forth. And, Medicaid will be more widely available because of the buy-in.
I see. Well, that's.
And then there are federal subsidies, for people who are beyond that, to be able to get health care.
Well, that answers my question. The only other thing I have to say, and I'm going to get off here, is as far as these guys getting these strap-ons are concerned.
Yeah.
the only strap-ons they ought to be allowed is the kind that they sell at the Adult Emporium.
Yeah, and you can't buy one of them in Alabama.
Well, I'm sure they could cross the state line and pick one up. But, I mean, the mind simply reels.
Well, yeah, it does. And I, do you follow Doonesbury at all, Jim?
No.
You know, the comic strip?
Sorry.
Well, Gary Trudeau has been having a fine, high old time with the California Starbucks problem. Because apparently there is a move afoot for people to go a-walking into Starbucks for their coffee with a gun on their hip. You know, frankly, getting jacked up on caffeine and carrying a gun is right up there with getting loaded and carrying a gun. The only people I want carrying guns are the people, you know, out and about, are the people who are completely inside the world, you know, with it, not altered.
Governed by the ATF.
And governed by sanity and reason.
Well, I mean, ATF, I think, tries to enforce the guidelines of sanity and reason.
Right, but bear in mind again, though, Jim, that if you go to one of these gun shows.
Oh, I know. They can trade and swap, and it's just a
rifle. No background check. You know, you can walk in a clown suit and say, I need a rifle, and there's a guy there that will sell you one, and there's not a blessed thing the government can do about it.
Well, that's unfortunate.
It should give people pause, if not the outright sweats.
Well, listen, you're right, and I'm going to allow you to continue your show, and good luck to you and your beloved Mountaineers, okay?
Well, thank you kindly. They're already playing, but I can't do much about that, but I'll try to at least catch the second half if they're not completely in the hole or something.
Well,
so cross your fingers, Jim.
Okay, you enjoy.
All right, take care.
Take care.
Bye now. That's Jim calling from not too awfully far away. And, you know, another addendum to his question, all small businesses get about a 50% premium tax credit for providing employee health insurance. They did a lot to make this within the profit structure as tolerable as possible. We all know that the ultimate answer is universal single payer, and that's the direction in which we have to go. And the Medicare buy-in that Representative Alan Grayson, maybe you heard him on Malloy last night, sounds like just an eminently reasonable human being. That's so important and so worth getting behind. And frankly, there needs to be a companion bill. You know, Bernie Sanders, you know, could you introduce that, please? That seems rational. Needs to be a companion bill in the Senate. But please understand that as we try to get our heads around what it is that these right-wingers are objecting to, please understand that they're not operating with anything even vaguely or remotely resembling sanity or reason. I have here, because I receive a lot of wingnut emails and proposals and pitches and so forth, I have here an open letter. It's an open letter to the Congress and the President. Dear Bob, well, this is before the open letter part. Dear Bob, in wake of the recent health care reform bill passing, there have been discrepancies on the actions and motives of the Tea Party movement. For this reason, the group stands bold in its message to those accusations in condemning harassment and threats of violence and encouraging only the display of peaceful protest. Mm-hmm. We, the leaders of the Tea Party movement of Florida, stand in stark opposition to any person using derogatory characterizations, threats of violence, or disparaging terms toward members of the Congress or the President. The Tea Party movement is a peaceful movement, and we denounce all forms of violence. If there's anybody watching, this includes racial attacks. We do not condone, accept, or encourage such behavior, and fully understand that while no evidence of such behavior has been offered, no, there's no broken windows, or no, that nothing. We believe it is important, there's no video footage, there's no audio of Representative John Lewis. No. We believe it is important to condemn it nonetheless. We support all efforts to bring such parties to justice and have encouraged full cooperation within our movement. I thought it was a leaderless movement. Oh, this is only Florida. Within our movement, and have asked for the same from the members of Congress who have leveled such claims. Oh, okay, so it's Congress's fault. Well, of course it is. They're stealing our freedom. And that man without a decent birth certificate. The Tea Party movement asks for fair and transparent investigation and prosecution of anyone accused of violence and also denounce any false claims. We also denounce false claims of violence. Does that mean, like, claims of false violence that's not really violent? I don't know. We will continue to stand together with like-minded patriots in defense of liberty, our Constitution, and our founding principles, as well as our precious bodily fluids. Oh, I added the precious bodily fluids part. We will work to protect the American people from those who aim her harm. Aim her harm? When wings take dream, what? Who wish to weaken our national economy and those who seek to reduce our political voice through innuendo and unsubstantiated claims with unsubstantiated broken windows and unsubstantiated rocks and bricks and coffins in yards and cut gas lines. The Tea Party movement strongly opposes legislation proposed by Congress and President Obama that takes away individual rights and grows government at the expense of the free market. A pledge pin? We will fight hard for our positions, but only while using peaceful means. So they're going to fight peacefully. Non-lethal, with non-lethal bullets, who knows? We are united in the effort to stop egregious government spending, spiraling deficits that we didn't pay any attention to while they were being created by the white man that we trusted to be in the office of the president for the last 8 years because he was white, and destructive taxation. We will not stop, relent, or fail to live up to the principles set forth in our Constitution, especially the parts that we imagine to exist but don't really. We, the undersigned, Freedom Works Florida, D.C. Works for Us, Tampa Tea Party, Orlando Tea Party, Miami 912 Project, 912 Project Florida, Titusville Patriots, Sun Tree Vieira 912, Tampa 912 Project Florida Tea Party, LLC, Florida Tea Party Party. Oh, they're a Tea Party Party. South Florida Tea Party, Inc. NoGovernmentHealthcare.com. North Lake Tea Party. Floridians Unite. North Pinellas 912 Project. Punta Gorda Tea Party. Gainesville Tea Party. And Doctors for Patient Freedom. I guess. William writing in says, easy to read and easy to understand. Would this be something on the order of a stop sign, as in stop the madness? Slippery when wet, slow down, sharp curves to the left, or is it showdown in the right? No kidding. Ron and Raleigh writing in, hey, Bob, there's something that I haven't heard mentioned. Many medical practices have reverted to fee-for-service models and no longer accept insurance. Will these practices now have to accept insurance? Have you heard or read anything in respect to this fee structure? Oh, I've heard about the fee structure. It's sort of the anarcho-Randy and John Galt approach to medicine. No, they won't be forced to accept insurance. They can go on, you know, they can go on with their little boutique practices, treating their delightfully white patients, and God love them and good luck to them, I guess. Sheesh. Thanks, Ron. Let's roll to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello?
Hello?
Oh, Bob, this is John Matthews calling.
Hey, John, how are you?
Not too bad. Couple of things. I was listening to you talk about Netanyahu earlier this evening.
Yes.
And I'll tell you, I spent half a day, or almost three-quarters of a day once, driving around Chicago with him back in 1983. And it was a very interesting thing. He used to work for, a lot of these guys engineers,
right,
that sort of thing.
Is this before or after his brother was killed at Entebbe?
I think this was after. He was an engineer for a company called Cytex, and he sold equipment for Cytex. And it was really interesting because a lot of that equipment, which was made in Israel, and a lot of it was sold in the United States and Europe, United States, a lot of that stuff used to use military components, and we used to buy, I used to run these graphic systems, and it was amazing, you know, how much money they would, the American government would put out, giving grants and all this, you know, military aircraft equipment, and ended up by being used in civilian equipment and sold back to the United States.
Well, that's a form of the corporate welfare that we've done for Israel for lo these many years.
Yeah, and that's why I think they're. You know, and Israel has a special place in this world. We have to recognize that. But at the same time, you know, they have to play ball a little bit once in a while too. And I don't think they've been.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't dispute Israel's right to exist. The only thing, John, is that I also don't dispute the Palestinians' right to exist.
Oh, definitely. And if we can do something to make it so that they can live better together. If they can live better together, maybe the rest of the world could, you know?
Yeah.
And I think it's time. And I think what Barack Obama did was excellent.
Yeah, me too. It's about time.
Yeah, I think it's about time that...
I don't know if you caught this or not, John, but in the U.K., on the floor of the Parliament... I think more than one member of parliament referred to Israel, and I think appropriately so, as a rogue state.
Yeah, because of their military capability. And, I mean, we worry about Iran, but, you know, Israel has a tremendous power, too.
Right, and I don't mean to seem simple-minded, John. I'm really not. But the we worry about Iran part doesn't make a whale of a lot of sense to me. I've done as much reading as my brain will allow for, and I can't find any evidence, real evidence out there, that the Iranians have any intentions toward having nuclear weapons. The IAEA says they don't. The American CIA says they don't. And I guess this is the kicker for me. Even if they did, you know, that form of analysis in which you assume the facts in a light most favorable to the person moving it, say Israel in this case, saying Iran wants to bomb the world. Here's what doesn't make any sense to me. You have nuclear Pakistan. You have Saudi Arabia, who could order the United States to perform a surgical nuclear strike or any other kind of nuclear strike practically on a whim. You have nuclear India, and you have nuclear Israel, and all of those are within easy striking distance of Iran and its rather vast petroleum reserves, right?
That's right.
Okay. If those were the circumstances, and we add into that the fact that, for instance, North Korea showed the world that the only way to make a crazy little warmonger like George Bush back off is to have your own nuclear program, then why wouldn't Iran want them? Okay, now again, I'm not saying that Iran does. I'm saying, viewing all of this in the light most favorable to Israel, why wouldn't Iran want them? Now, add to that the fact that the minute that Iran develops enough fissile material to start building nuclear weapons, they will at best have enough to build two or three, maybe five. At which point, they know full well that Israel is sitting there ready, willing, and able and capable of delivering at least 200 thermonuclear devices right on top of Iran. Now, the only way that scenario makes any sense is if we assume that the entirety of the Iranian people and the entirety of the Iranian government, hardline, radical, and fundamentalist though they are also crazy. I mean, insane, as in, you know, can't tell the difference between reality and fantasy. That's the only way that scenario works. Do you get my meaning?
Yeah, well, when it comes to Iran, I think the best thing we should do in Iran is support the young people. If we supported the young people in Iran, they'd take over and we'd have another nice country we could deal with. But
if we were willing to stay out of their business, because remember, John, all of this, every last problem that we have with Iran arises out of the meddling that we could not resist doing in their own internal domestic political business back in the early 1950s when the CIA overturned Mohammad Mossadegh and installed Reza Pahlavi, the Shah of Iran, back on the peacock throne.
And he was a thief.
Oh, he was a thief. He was a murderer. He was a thug. He was, what were George Bush's words? A brutal dictator who killed his own people.
And we supported him.
Wholeheartedly.
And we took care of him when he moved to the United States. And by the way, we took care of him when he had cancer. We won't even do that for our own people.
Oh, man, what a point. Oh, score. Toaster for you tonight, John.
You know, another thing, too, about talking about, you know, I'm a believer we should only have a one-payer medical system.
Me, too.
And I, you know, I live in the United States. I'm an American citizen, but I'm also a Canadian citizen. And I lived in Canada for a while, for about 10 years, while the once they implemented the one-payer system in Canada. And the big misconception of, that Americans have about the Canadian system is that the Canadian system is not one system. Each province has a slightly different system. And
You mean like states' rights, like Dennis Kucinich is arguing for?
Yeah, well, they're all basically a one-payer system, but they function a little differently. Like, for example, Ontario has OHIP. And in Ontario, what happens is the insurance system is, it's run by the state. It's actually like an insurance policy. And the only difference is, if you're unemployed or on unemployment insurance or something like that, the state pays your premium. But everybody pays into one payer system. Where and basically what happened in Canada when they introduced the healthcare system in Canada, the federal government set down a set of guidelines, and then the provinces could work out and make it function in any way they wanted to, but it had to meet with the federal guidelines. But the interesting thing about the Canadian system when they brought it in, and I remember very well because I lived in Montreal and Quebec. And one of the things that really happened in Quebec that I found amazing was having a one-payer system or a medical system like that, people became a lot more independent. And it was easier for small businesses to hire, like, for example, engineers and,
certainly,
and professional people, because they were more willing to work for small companies because their major benefits were being taken care of by the government.
Well, and look at the fact that the auto manufacturers beat a hot path to Canada for the very same reasons.
Right. Well, right. I mean, you take General Motors and all the major auto manufacturers have plants in Canada. And a lot of the cars, in fact, there's a big joke in the United States, you know, if the car rusts or doesn't run very well, they say, well, that one must have been made in Canada. But, you know, but the Canadian automobile industry actually is in better shape. Now, the interesting thing about this whole thing, and a lot of people don't realize, that there's only one place that I know of on the North American continent where there's a housing boom going on, and that's in Canada. Now, if the Canadian medical system or the socialist system that people talk about is so bad, how come the economy is still thriving?
Why are they still experiencing growth?
That's right. And look at the banks that are moving down from Canada into the United States. TD, you know, the TD Bank has been buying up American banks like crazy, and it's basically the Toronto Dominion Bank. And Cadillac Fairview, all these companies are moving into the United States and buying up. They have the capital. The banks are very solvent, and they have the capital, and they're taking advantage of the situation in the United States right now. I'm not saying that's good. In fact, I'm not sure that that's a good thing, because I think Americans should have control over their own country, and we're losing it. And it's because we just won't get together and solve our problems. I mean, we have, I hate to say it, but I think our government's absolutely dysfunctional. And
I think you're right.
I do like Barack Obama. I think he himself is trying his best. I also like Joe Biden. I met Joe Biden on one occasion. And I like these people. I think they're trying, but I think the system is broken.
I think the system is in very bad shape in many ways, John. And I would also go so far as to say that Barack Obama may be getting some bad advice here and there that may even run contrary to his own better intentions.
Well, I think time is going to tell. I'm hoping, but I got a letter from Michael Moore today and an email, and they're already starting up these movements and are getting ready for the next election. Here in Vermont, we're already planning the next election, and there's some parties planned for this weekend. People are getting together, and they're talking about, you know, going to a one-payer system, and they're going to push it again. I think we were all let down. I think we got a lot of people, and I know myself, I worked very hard in a lot of campaigning, and I paid out money to help people get elected, and hopefully, the next election, we're going to see a one-payer system. I hope so. It might not happen, but
we have. But we have to. We have to persist. Not start, but persist in the work now. That's why Alan Grayson's bill is so important, I think, John. You know, that allows people to buy into Medicare who are under 65.
Yeah, we have to do something like that.
Because you know, the road to single payer was, you know, a lot of us were solidly behind John Conyers and Dennis Kucinich's H.R. 676, Medicare for All. And really, that's what we're talking about, expanding Medicare into lower age brackets so that it becomes available to anyone who wants it.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that I think Barack Obama made a mistake is, I think he should have brought people in like Howard Dean or maybe Bernie Sanders or some of these people into the party, into the cabinet, because I think these were real fighters. I don't know, but, you know, I know Howard Dean was really committed to it. I've met him on many occasions, and I know...
Oh, Howard Dean was absolutely committed to it, and the reason...
Dennis Kucinich as well. Yeah. I mean, I was watching him on Bill Maher last week, and, I mean, I like the man. I think he's very, very sincere. And I don't think he's had a chance, you know. Well, he's had a chance. He's been elected.
But let me point out, if I may, John, that the reason that I think, you know, I said earlier that I think President Obama has gotten some bad advice. Let me point out to you that the reason, in large part, I think that Howard Dean couldn't take a bigger role in the Obama administration is because of the absolute disgust and disdain that Rahm Emanuel holds Howard Dean in. Remember, it was Howard Dean who first posited the 50-state strategy whereby Democrats would contest every election in every state. And Rahm Emanuel, in his effort to put the disgusting blue dogs into office, fought that at every turn. And that's, you know, that there isn't... Now, you know, maybe this sounds a little bit like gossip, but there's no love lost between those two people. And there would be no way that those two could operate inside an administration together. You know, remember when we were talking about, the issues relating to, for instance, the closure of Guantanamo. Who opposed that hotly and heavily? Rahm Emanuel did. When we were talking about the release of the torture pictures that should have been put out so that we could do some national healing over it. Who opposed it hotly and heavily? Rahm Emanuel did. Rahm Emanuel is a cancer inside the Obama presidency.
I never really thought about it that much, but maybe you're right. Maybe you're right.
You know, Rahm Emanuel is a DLC-er. He's a middle-of-the-roader. He's a go-along-to-get-along guy, even though he is, you know, has this in-your-face reputation. The fact of the matter is, he's the kind of insider that runs directly contrary to everything that was manifested inside Barack Obama's message of hope and change. So dig around on it. You know, feel free to disagree or whatever, but dig around on it, and tell me if I'm wrong.
No, I don't think so. I never really thought about it that way, and I never really analyzed it that much, you know, that part of it. And you're probably right. You know, maybe that's where the problem is. The people that have been selected to be around Barack Obama maybe are not the best. You know, not the best mix, you know. Could be. There's one other thing I wanted to mention, if I can. I know
it's
a short evening.
No, that's okay. Go right ahead.
I live in Vermont, as you know, and, you know, I hear you talk quite often about West Virginia and the mountains. And I've been realizing, you know, that's one of the things that you have down there that it's one of the reasons I like listening to you is you talk very much about the mountains and your love of where you live. And there's, you know, maybe that's something that would be kind of interesting to have, like, not an affiliation, but some kind of a communication between Vermont and where you live, because the mountains are so important to people who live here.
Oh, absolutely. You're an Appalachian person just like I am. You just have the good fortune of living in mountains that don't have coal under them.
Well, that's right. I mean, and I feel for you there because that's one thing we don't... You know, do you realize, you know, primarily coal is used to create electricity?
Right.
37% of all the electricity produced in America never gets used.
Yeah, it's lost in the transmission lines. It's lost, and in fact, the number, if you want to drill down one more layer, John, the amount that when you burn coal, you know, coal has BTU ratings just like any other the flammable source, and the amount of potential energy contained in coal, when you burn coal, I think you get. Just from the initial burning, you only get like 35, 40, 45% of the potential energy inside it to begin with. So then when you siphon off another 37%, what are you getting? And yet here where I live, we just, you know, we are subject, just as any other state is, to the tender mercies of our Public Service Commission. And our Public Service Commission just handed down not too long back, and God knows it's made us weep and ache, a 33% rate hike for our power company. So our power bills just, you know, not because of usage, but just because of a whim in Charleston, our power bills just went up 33%.
It's terrible.
It's criminal. And yet at the same time, I got to drive by signs on the highway that says coal is clean and cheap.
Well, it ain't clean. That's
and it ain't cheap.
No, it isn't. But see, one of the big problems is with the way we're using energy in America is we've had this whole attitude that bigger has got to be better, and we keep making these big power plants and big instead of looking at how we can really solve the problems. One of the big problems is that we don't need these big plants. You know, and we should look at industry and how we use energy and how many times we could use the same energy. It's a whole thing I've been doing a lot of studying about, and we're just not keeping up. As an industrialized nation, we're being driven by a few large corporations.
Without a doubt, John, we absolutely are. Except there are pockets of forward thinking, and there are pockets in this state they're in this country where states are considering what a just coal-free future looks like. I received a note from our dear friend Jude from in the state of Washington today about a huge move that's being made in Washington to make that state coal-free. And our good friend Jeff Biggers, the author of Reckoning at Eagle Creek, had a post at Huffington Post today talking about the potential for a move in Los Angeles to go coal-free that, if they do so, will be the equivalent of removing 11 million automobiles from the highways if they just go coal-free with their electricity generation.
And the thing is there's so many new technologies being developed every day, and they're not getting a chance. We're not even looking at a lot of them. And I'll just tell you another interesting one. I want to build a house. You know how cold the winter you just went through down there.
Oh yes.
And I got a break this year because our winter was actually mild by comparison. And I usually in my home I burn about 4 quarts of wood a year. And this year, I don't think I burnt that much. So I had a break this year. Now, I want to build another home, okay, that doesn't use any heating system but the sun.
Can be done.
Some people call that a solar home. But it's a little different. I want to build a solar home that has what we call a solar battery underneath it, okay? It was a system developed by a Harvard engineer who lives in upstate New York. And I had several meetings with this man, and I've been working on the idea of building this house. If you go to the bank and you want to borrow money to build a house that doesn't use a conventional heating system, you cannot get a federal government loan on it.
I had no idea.
That's a fact. And the only way I can get a mortgage on a house like this, which is a complete off-the-grid home that uses no fossil fuels, no propane or any other heating system other than the sun, and a 12-volt solar panel to create the circulation for the unit. That can be, sometime I'll send you the plans. I just made an animation that shows how this system works. And I went to the bank and I was talking to them and they won't give you a loan. They'll give me an in-house loan, but I cannot get a Freddie Mac or any of these type of mortgages because it doesn't comply and it doesn't use fossil fuels. And that's a fact.
That's astonishing. That makes my mind reel, John.
But it's the truth. I mean, that's why we talk a game. We talk about making change. We talk about having a green planet, but as soon as you start to do it, the roadblocks are there. And the other thing, you know, I know where I can go on for the subject forever, and I don't want to be on all night because you got other people, I'm sure, but it's an interesting phenomenon. Now, there's a mansion on Mount Mansfield, which is in a resort area in Vermont. It's a 30,000-square-foot mansion that the building does not change temperature 1 degree all year round. It's on the side of a mountain. It's actually dug into part of a mountain. And it has no heating system in it other than the sun. And the only oil they use in that property, and it's owned by the Kellogg family, the only heating system that is used in that building is for the swimming pool. They have an Olympic swimming pool, and they use oil to heat the swimming pool. And if they can do that, and I know the architect, Jerry McDermott, is an architect's friend of mine who designed the building, and what's nice about it, the humidity in the building doesn't change from when it's I think, about 45% year-round. You know how when you heat a home, it gets very dry, and this building...
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
When you heat with the sun and you're not using a lot of excessive heat to produce to maintain a building, the humidity stays normal all year round. And not only that, the system automatically reverses itself and cools the building in the summertime.
Well, you know, John, it occurs to me that one of the things that lies within what you're discussing is the need to create not just a market for the technology, but a market for the homes as well. Because David in Tennessee has mentioned to me that those regulations with the government sponsored loans are driven that way because there are so few people who want off the grid right now, and that because of that it negatively impacts the resale value of the home, and that roadblock is what lays waste to the loan program as you've described it. So what we've got to have is more of those things coming online with some sort of private creative financing that will make these things appealing to people. You know, I heard Bobby Kennedy Jr. talking about the fact that, you know, his home produces more electricity than it uses. And I can't imagine what it would be like to live that way. But the place where we need to see those kinds of homes built, frankly, and all encouragement in the world to you building one up there, but we need to see these things built here in Central Appalachia. Does that strike a chord with you? Because we've got to come into the belly of the beast, and this is the belly of electrical generation from coal, because the prevailing propaganda around here is, well, we may have wind and solar someday, but, you know, the technology's just not ready right now.
Oh, believe me, the technology is more than ready. You know, just in this exercise of building this type of house. Right now, I know everything that you shouldn't do to build a house. I live in a log home that I built myself 10 years ago. And I'll tell you, it aesthetically is gorgeous, but it is not the way to build a home. Not in today's day and age. So now I have learned the hard way of what you shouldn't do. And I can tell you that, you know, for example, building with structural panels. If you build a home and you wrap the foundation in a membrane to prevent moisture from entering into the building, the foundation, you save 10% of your heating bill right there.
Yeah.
No kidding. Just now, if you were to take all the homes in America, and if we could get them off of fossil fuels, just think about the impact. That's where we've got to start, and I think we're going in the wrong direction sometime. If we could get, and then if we had to, like, you know, where you live when you have to generate electricity, put the money into wind where it makes sense. Put money into solar. I'm a much stronger proponent of solar than wind, but that's, you know, it's for several reasons, but it doesn't matter. They all have their place. And transpose what we do, and you'll see we could do so much in this country. For example, can you imagine, just think about your computers that, you know, all the people that are listening to your program right now are all sitting next to their computer. Now, most computers inside work on, you know, 5 volts, 10 volts, 12 volts. And we have a big transformer on these things that takes it from 120 volts and brings it down to 5 volts, and even the chip which runs under millivolts, sorry. If we got rid of that transformer, put a solar panel outside your home, but, you know, and it's DC, and run a 12-volt battery and then connect it up to your computer, you'd save a fortune in electricity. Because the first thing you do when you build a solar home is you've got to try and figure out where the load is. Where is the electricity going? You start having to think about things, not just putting a plug in the wall, but thinking about how you use electricity and how you use all these things. And, you know, we could save a lot of money just getting rid of the vampire power in the homes in America. So how many coal plants, fired electrical plants, could we shut down just by getting rid of vampire power?
Oh, The number is significant. The fact of the matter is, for instance, John, where mountaintop removal is concerned, we could eliminate mountaintop removal tomorrow, and the lights would never dim. We could eliminate the need for mountaintop removal coal simply by engaging in energy conscious behavior. You know, not illuminating rooms that don't have people in them, for instance.
Yeah, that could be a way of saving, but just going to LED lighting systems.
There you go. There's one.
And
by the way, let me mention not just for you, but for everybody else listening, there is a brilliant documentary out there that's several years old now, but well worth the watch. It is called Kilowatt Hours. And only thing is, it's kilowatt O-U-R-S, not H-O-U-R-S, kilowatt hours. And I think the website's kilowatthours.org. And that is a brilliant exploration of the things that can be done to reduce electricity needs. And, you know, the state of California did a ton of that back in the 70s. To this day, their consumption is less, their average per capita consumption is, I believe, less than that of the average American in other states, simply because they got smart about how they were using electricity.
That's right. There's a couple of interesting things. There's a project that was done up in Guelph, Ontario, Canada. An interesting project was done on what they did is they took five houses. They built five houses together, and they found that if you, when it comes to solar or to renewable energy, that if you group houses together or group things together in small groups, and you share in the equipment, if you will, for example, batteries. You know, to build a 4,000 or 5,000 watt power system for your home, you're looking at about $25,000 or $30,000. If you build three houses, let's say three or four houses within a reasonable proximity of each other, and you share some of the components, you greatly reduce that cost of building. And when you start looking at things like this and how we could work communities, and then there's another interesting thing I found in Europe, the way, especially in the last century, small industry in Europe, a cottage industry, where people could take the energy that was used in an industry, and in a small town they could use the byproducts of the energy of that industry, they could use it again in other ways. So that for every, for example, every BTU, every watt you use, it gets used twice or maybe three times before it's gone. And we're not looking at things like this. And it would help, especially small communities like where you live,
right,
in the mountains. We could bring industries in that make sense, that we could put people to work and change the way we do things, go back a little bit and look at the way we used to do things, and we'll see that there may be some good ideas out there. We don't have to reinvent the wheel. We just got to go back and find the wheel we had before,
Yeah, well, it's like I say about the Appalachian culture. Before the advent of coal-fired electricity, we were sustainable before sustainable was cool. There's ways.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say there are things we can go back to, and there are things that we can advance into the coming century. All of this. Compare, for instance. I don't know if you heard Brad and Desi with their Green News report, but lo and behold, there's another cap and trade bill being contemplated or some such. And, 2.1 now has even bigger giveaways for the filthiest polluters. And frankly, the science isn't even behind stuff like carbon capture and storage. It's a complete, alchemical, chimera, if you will. And lo and behold, look in these bills, look at Waxman-Markey, look at the stuff in the Senate. Look how much welfare money is in there, corporate welfare money, for coal. The comparison, I think there's $1 billion for renewables and something in excess of $60 billion for the coal industry in the form of welfare. You know, is that really what 21st century America needs, John?
We don't need it. We don't. We absolutely. And the thing is, when you really look at these things, we are not creating any more jobs. We're not creating any more wealth for people. We're creating wealth for some people, but for most people, we're losing jobs. We're losing a competitive edge because it's not an efficient system anymore. And if we don't look at it and we don't change, we're going to lose. And it goes back to even how hard it is to make people understand that we need a one-payer medical system to make this country more efficient again and you know, people can...
And business-friendly. Yeah, business-friendly. You know, Michael Moore said the other day in something I saw that he'd written that perhaps this finally catches on when we incentivize it for business, because the nature of America is such that stuff only gets going really good when it turns out to be good for business.
Well, you know,
I don't necessarily agree with why that works, but historically speaking, there's a lot of evidence to point to the fact that it does work that way. You know, when we realize that American manufacturing can only get up on its feet and only begin to compete with the Chinese when all of America's workers are covered with health care that is provided under a single-payer system, and that it will be cheaper for business, then, you know, business will be out there hollering, ooh, give it to us. Until then, you know, it's up to us to march forward.
The other thing is how do we expect to compete on a world platform? On a world scale, when we can't even, I don't know where you live, but I live in, you know, I have to use a satellite for my internet. And we can't even get high-speed internet where I live. I have to have a satellite in order to get that kind of speed. And
that's, you know, prohibitively expensive. I do know that.
Right, it is. And fortunately, I now work at home, and I manage to make a living at home. It's not easy, but I do it. And the thing is that if you look at the internet and our capabilities and software, the United States is now 17th in the world as far as our level of in that technology. A country like, I think it's Denmark, is now going to have everybody in Denmark is going to be covered by high-speed internet.
Yeah.
One way or another, whether it be wireless.
And what constitutes high speed in other parts of the world makes what we call high speed look like dial up.
Yeah.
You know, the deployment of high speed internet has absolutely got to be a part of any sort of strategy going forward, and it has to be something that everybody can afford. You know, the fact of the matter is the statistics are out there, and when you look at them, you'll find, John, that blogging, for instance, and general internet access is still largely a white middle class to upper class undertaking. I mean, there are tons of people around here who are not elderly, who are not Luddites, who do not have internet or even a computer in their home. And frankly, as we look at these new economic models, every new economic model I've ever run across has a significant component of the internet just factored in. And so as long as we have not fully deployed broadband, we're basically competing with one foot in a bucket in many ways, I think.
Well, I mean, to a point where even our education system, we can't, you know, there's children who are come home here in Vermont. And Vermont is trying to get high-speed internet all over, but it's cost, and everybody keeps complaining about cost.
Well, and it's tough in mountainous areas, too. It truly is.
Well, wireless is, and one of the problems we've gone through is that once the company that took over from Verizon is having a problem because
Oh, you guys got dumped by Verizon too? Same thing happened here.
Right. Well, when they dumped it, Verizon, you know, they kept the cream and they got rid of all the other stuff. And that's, you know, that's another thing that corporate America has been doing to us is not being very good to us, and they're getting off the hook in a lot of these particular cases. But what happens is high-speed internet is so important. But what has happened here is that these promises these companies are making, the small wireless companies have given up because, you know, in the mountains, these small wireless companies could have taken over and provided a service. I called the governor once and I told him, I said, why don't you, the government just make available some T1 lines in strategic areas and allow these small companies to feed off of it. But they didn't do that, and here we are, you know, a few years down the road fighting to get DSL.
Right, exactly. And I want to take you backwards just for a minute before we go, John. You mentioned, you know, there's a sort of kinship between Appalachian Vermont and Appalachian West Virginia. A really great example of that in a sort of opposite model. There was a study done a year or so ago that has engendered a program that is now running on ABC featuring Jamie Oliver, a British chef. And the study was done to determine the healthiest and least healthy small town in America. Well, the healthiest small town in America is, lo and behold, Burlington, Vermont, for a variety of reasons.
Yeah, I've heard that, and it's an interesting fact. I never would have believed it, but it apparently it's true.
Well, Burlington, Vermont's got a reasonably highly educated population. Burlington has a good selection of grocery stores in which you can buy healthy foods. Burlington has developed areas for getting, you know, good exercise and intensely good quality of life stuff. But the unhealthiest small town in America, by comparison, is Huntington, West Virginia, and that's where Jamie Oliver's doing this show. Not this show, but his show.
Why is that?
Well, it's for a variety of reasons. Huntington, West Virginia is in central Appalachia. Huntington, West Virginia is as toxified as any other area in central Appalachia by coal. Huntington, West Virginia has little in the way of life skills teaching for proper nutrition and proper eating. There's very little in the way of infrastructure for making it possible for people to get out and get the exercise they need. Probably the great big poster child for Huntington being unhealthy, you know, I don't know what Burlington's annual festival is. It, you know, maybe it's the Lake Festival or whatever. But the annual.
Well, they got a Green Mountain Choo Choo, which is an eating festival.
Well, there you go. Well, guess what they have in Huntington? They've got a hot dog festival, John.
Oh, man.
Huntington, West Virginia has a hot dog festival. And, you know, I'm no elitist. I'm no snob. And I love, you know, I love a good dog like just about anybody else who's not a vegetarian. And I think there are even vegetarian hot dogs, tofu dogs or some such. But it's not a lifestyle. Well, it is in places like Central Appalachia because it is cheap, accessible food that can be readily had by people who are who are crushed within the economic structure of their area. So, you know, just a little food for thought. John, I do have to run along, but I'll tell you what, I've really enjoyed our conversation, and I hope you won't let it be the last one for a while.
Okay, I'd love to talk to you again, and thank you very much. I listen to you often, but I don't have a chance to call you very often, and I enjoyed this tonight.
Well, whenever the spirit moves you, John, do feel free, please.
Thank you.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
Bye now. Calling from the civilization known as Vermont, that is John. I haven't heard from John in a long time. It was good to hear from him. And I am going to knock off here in a few minutes because they're going to start the second half of the Mountaineer game. And frankly, the scoring updates are such that I am fit to scream, okay? I just got to be there. It'll probably curse the Mountaineers and we'll lose by 30 the minute that I start paying attention to the game, because that's how it works. But before I knock off, there's a couple of things that have to be shared. We talked about the right-wing hate and the right-wing violence. Well, let's add this one more onto our little tote board. I just got this heads up from our buddy Corey, and she sent along the following from Reuters. The office of Representative Anthony Weiner on Thursday received a threatening letter containing an unidentified white powder. Quote, earlier today, an envelope containing white powder and a threatening letter was delivered to my community office in Kew Gardens, the Democratic congressman said in a statement issued by his office. My first priority is the safety of my staff and neighbors, and the authorities are currently taking steps to investigate and resolve the situation. Weiner's office in Kew Gardens, part of the New York City Borough of Queens, was closed for investigation. So they're back to the white powder game again. Sick, right-wing bastards. You don't... Please be careful. Please just be aware of your surroundings, like I said the other night. It's not a joke when I say these freaks walk among us, and they walk freely among us. Sometimes they're carrying guns. Don't stop your advocacy. Don't stop your activism, but be aware of the world that you live in. And so I apologize for knocking off 25 minutes early, but I just gotta. I'll be back tomorrow night for Front Porch Friday. Thanks, everybody. Thanks to all of you who have stepped up so prodigiously to take a little bit of the sweat off of our brows here at the Horn. About keeping, you know, making sure there's an April with the Horn now that we're almost done with March. Thank you. We go month to month. We just do. It would be nice to stop sweating at all. We're $500 away from meeting our March goal. It would be nice to not hear me do a pitch for another, for three or four shows. God knows I would like not doing one. Because I just don't like doing it. But thank you. Thank you for stepping up. All of you. If you can, those of you who haven't, you can always go to headonradionetwork.com. The contribute tab is there. There's a PayPal button and a snail mail address, however it is you wish to participate in keeping this dream of independent liberal media alive. Thanks to everybody who makes all this happen. Thanks to John Fox, Peter Godbold, Ben Birch. Thanks to Sue. Thanks to Lottie. To our news ninjas, Gene and Susan, thanks. To our blogger, Texas Betsy. To Matt Osborne, our Southeast correspondent at Osborne, Inc., OSBORNEINK.com, thanks. To my head writer, David in Tennessee, thank you. To the hardest working, bravest people I know, the people at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ColeRiverWind.org, I offer continuing thanks. And always, always, always. Gina, it's all for you. Oh, and by the way, let's go, Mountaineers!
show. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! This feels like deja vu. Deja vu, because this is what I said a couple of minutes ago when I wasn't talking to anybody. Because of gremlins and creepy things that live inside computers and electrical, photons or something. Sheesh. It's Thursday. I'm thrilled to be here. I hope you haven't all run away already. I don't know if this was a case of Bob's. No, we've been having gremlins all day long. If suddenly the audio starts sounding like that, that's what gremlins sound like when they're coming through your speakers. I've been listening to them a lot today. Don't know what it is, but days are short somewhere, and eventually we'll find it. Pick, shovel, axe, 220, 235, whatever it takes. We'll get it. It is Thursday, and I'm awfully glad. Awfully glad to be here, especially in light of the technical creatures living, nasty things living in my machine. But anyway. We're going to have at it this evening for at least a while, and I hope you will grant me a little bit of tolerance tonight. The Mountaineers, my beloved Mountaineers, play the University of Washington Huskies in the round of the Sweet 16 in the NCAA tournament. I know, I've already lost half the audience by merely mentioning sports. But this is a big chunk of our identity here in West Virginia. And it doesn't happen that often, and I'm going to be tempted to knock off about the last hour of the program. So, just be forewarned. It's a statewide religious holiday today, as a matter of fact. You see. So we got that going on. But I'll be back tomorrow night, just right as rain and regular as can be. Early on, I want to start out by thanking those of you who have stepped up so prodigiously, to push us up to the, three quarters of the way to done with the March fundraising mark. It is incredibly important that we reach these things, and you guys have done a bang-up job. Here, it's the 25th of March, we've only got to raise $500 more in the next 6 days. And you know what? Getting that sweaty monkey off my back, off our backs, so that we know that, we finished March and we're going to get April done. So important. It is so very important. And the gratitude I feel, and we all feel, toward those of you who continue to make this little experiment in independent liberal broadcasting happen. The gratitude cannot be overexpressed or even adequately expressed, as far as I'm concerned. So thank you. Now, where to go? Let's start with some email. Okay? I had a couple that I wanted to get to. I heard today from our buddy Phil from Sydney, and Phil is in the chat room from time to time, and you all know him. And Phil dropped me a note today saying, "Bob, I was wondering and hoping that today, March 25th, you might make a special mention on your show about Greece. Today is Greece's special Independence Day. This is the day it finally rid itself of its Muslim Ottoman occupiers after 400 years of subjugation. All over the world, the vast diaspora of Greece are celebrating by way of marches. Even at my children's primary school, there were big celebrations in the form of singing, dancing, and food stalls. It was charming to see children of all races, including little Chinese kids, getting involved. As for poor Greece, these days it is much beleaguered. It made the tragic mistake of entering into that corrupt and filthy organization called the European Union. I witnessed an explosion in the cost of living, with most people not benefiting from such a union. Greece was laid siege to by the modern-day Ottomans in the form of Goldman Sachs, where its resources were looted, and the poor populace were left holding the bag. In the aftermath, the fault was laid at the feet of ordinary Greeks, who were considered somewhat lazy and corrupt. The so-called European allies were awaiting the remaining blood cleanse. Some German MPs even mockingly said that Greece should consider selling some of its islands or even converting the Parthenon into a casino. Says Phil, to hell with them. In the wings are the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, who have their minds set on sucking the marrow dry out of Greece's bones, who salivate at the thought of turning Greece into a third-world nation. To hell with them. Corrupt Greek politicians are saying that Greece needs to implement austerity measures and that the belts need to be tightened so hard they will sever the body in two. To hell with them. Is this how they treat an ancient country and culture which has given the world so much, including a little thing that everyone keeps uttering called democracy? To hell with them. If the financial crisis is not enough, the country has become flooded by illegal immigrants, most of whom originate or gain access through the old enemy, Turkey. They are hostile to Greece and have no intention of integrating, but rather forming ghettos. I even saw a photo of an Afghan man spitting on the Greek flag in Greece, probably because he felt offended, as there is a shape of a cross on the flag's design. Greece can be spared accusations of religious bigotry, as they suffered hard under Islamic tyranny. No one wants them. There's not enough work. Yet the EU masters in Brussels dictate to Greece that they have to stay. To hell with them as well. I feel like it's some sort of conspiracy to push the final nail in the coffin and finish off one of the world's oldest cultures. To hell with all those blood-sucking leeches. So on this day of celebration, says Phil, spare a thought for poor little old Greece, who survived countless invasions and occupations, but somehow might not make it through this one. Greece has been much on my mind of late, and as I've said on a couple of occasions, I have not done justice to what is happening in Greece by any stretch of the imagination, and I should have. You know, one of the hallmarks of this show has always been the fact that we look for things that are a little bit off the beaten path and outside the mainstream of news that the rest of America usually gets. And sometimes I do, I admit, get sucked into the issues of the day, and that has certainly been the case with health care. But I will also say, in my own defense and the defense of the callers to the program, that healthcare has been and will remain critically important to this country, because until the United States takes care of its own, we will be hard pressed to reach out when others need us as well, as we have done so admirably in the past, the rebuilding of Europe, the rebuilding of Asia after the Second World War. But what is happening in Greece is a tragedy. And you know what a romantic I am, and by romantic I mean, you know, not the sort of romantic, you know, ooh, Fabio, rip my bodice. No, not cheap pulpy paperback romantic, no. No, but a romantic in the sense of, well, Lord Byron. Lord Byron, one of the great romance poets who ran off to fight for Greek independence in the 19th century, and did, I believe, die there. the romance of yearning ever to travel and to see these places that from the time I was tiny was taught are the very acme of what it means to be civilized. How many times on this program, and just in a couple of nights ago, I referenced the value and meaning of catharsis. We don't even have the word catharsis without the ancient Greek culture that gave it to us. We have no concepts of tragedy or comedy or of how storytelling even works without the ancient Greeks. So, my apologies. And I understand the passion that Phil brings to bear very well. It's the passion of a person who loves a place and grieves from afar as he sees it being looted. You know, I remember back before the September 11th, 2001 attacks, I remember the outrage that I felt when I learned that the fundamentalist fiends, enemies of all that is civilized, the Taliban in Afghanistan, had blown to smithereens a world heritage site known as the Bamiyan Buddhas. Carved out of the living rock, these Buddhas were, and surrounded by caves that were inhabited by Buddhist monks, hermits, ascetics. But because they represented because the Buddhas were a representation of the human form, the wild-eyed fanatic fundamentalists of the Taliban blew them to dust because their invisible cloud friend says you can't do that. I can't begin to describe the rage I felt, the horror. You know, Phil mentions the Parthenon. Unless I am mistaken, the Parthenon stood relatively unmolested over time until it finally exploded because it was being used as a munitions dump to store gunpowder and a shell hit it or some such. That's when the Parthenon finally lost its roof. That didn't happen in the 11th century. That happened only post Marco Polo, post Western civilization. Everything, even the iconography of the Christian Church, owes all to ancient Greece. There is a reason that the representations that most of us recognize as Jesus, you know, the sort of honey blonde haired fellow with the blue eyes and the closely cropped beard, that guy. There's a reason he looks the way he looks. He is an overlay. He is Phoebus Apollo 2.1 from the arts of the ancients. There's a reason that God Almighty in our representations looks as he does. He is a Semitic overlay onto Olympian Zeus, and the sculpture by Phidias that was housed in the temple designed by Praxiteles, I think. Yeah. Whew! You have no idea how far back in otherwise weakened and semi-debilitated brain cells I have to go to come up with that stuff. I'm in love with it. I'm in love with it all. I've been doing a bunch of reading lately on the mysteries that still remain and surround ancient Crete, another of those cultures that inhabit the Mediterranean. You know, I would love nothing better than to go and live for a couple of years on Crete and eat that Mediterranean diet, watch about 100 pounds of ugly fat slip away, my cholesterol go right through the floor, and you know, go down to the shore and eat the occasional little bit of the uni. Oh, yeah. I don't know. learn to pluck away on a bouzouki, perhaps, or some such, and wander among the ruins. God, how I'd love to do that. I can't begin to describe it. To go and see Thermopylae, where literally Western civilization was arguably saved from a Persian invasion, it was pretty much the last time the Persians got froggy. To go to Marathon, to stand at Sunion Head and look off into what the Greeks called the wine dark sea. Oh, how I'd love it. But as it stands, I think I must largely content myself with going there in my head. And to what degree, to whatever degree that I engage in prayer, pray that these magic remnants of our first stuttering steps toward full humanity can somehow remain on the planet. So, Phil, yes, yes, I do mark March the 25th, and I thank you very much for raising it to my attention. And anybody who wants to sort of work or expand upon the economic nightmare that has been foisted upon Greece is welcome to do so. More than welcome to do so. So that's just a starting place. Other starting places, well, I mentioned that I have not been spending the time that I need to be spending doing world radio travel, as it were. And Phil mentioned the fact that ancient Greece is frequently noted as having given us as its greatest gift. Frankly, I would debate that, because I love theater, and I love representational art, and I love the gift of the grape. And I love fine olive oil, and I love, well, you know. But democracy. Democracy. Demokrasia. Demoskrasia. People something. And we, in turn, here in the 21st century, in about 24, 5 centuries, since the notion was come up with, have decided that democracy is something that is often best delivered at the muzzle of a gun. I continue to disagree. Even the ancient Greeks learned, the Athenians, and we say the Greeks, but it was the Athenians who did the democracy thing. They even learned, at the great cost of their own empire, all of it, and even the Athenians' own freedom, that one is best not to try to deliver demoskrasia at the point of a spear, or in our case, the muzzle of a gun. But we do worry about democracy, and we do maintain certain fictions that if we can just get something that we can reasonably call democracy in some far-off, underdeveloped country, that we can call democracy without snickering up our sleeves very much, that we have somehow accomplished something. And so it was that once upon a time, George W. Bush, the man who in the video, if you haven't seen it yet, I'm sure you will at some point, the man who in the video recently, he and it was Garrett mentioned this on the program last night. I've seen the video. Agnes saw the video. She said, Bob, play that back. Played it back. She said, Bob, play that again. Bob, that can't be happening. Well, yes, dear, it can. And it did. George Bush sort of shaking hands with a Haitian and then wiping the black person stuff off on Bill Clinton's sleeve. Jesus. But one of George Bush's great buddies for his invasion of the Middle East, or, well, Central Asia, One of his great buddies was President Kurmanbek Bakiyev, president of Kyrgyzstan. Too many consonants, not enough vowels. Kyrgyzstan. President Kurmanbek Bakiyev has told a national congress that, he just doesn't see Western-style democracy working in Kyrgyzstan. And he says democracy's run its course there. We've had too much of this freedom business. People just saying what they want to say whenever they want to say it. It's not worth it. No, President Kurmanbek Bakiyev says that he envisions something that he calls consultative democracy, where there are dialogues with influential social groups, and that would be more in keeping with his country's traditions of boiling political opponents alive, because he does that. There's only one problem. Just one little problem. We're sort of busy with a little chunk of Kyrgyzstan. We have, we have these air bases there. And we use the air bases to go bomb brown people. But President Kurmanbek Bakiyev recently said, encourages society, which based on community life and responsibility, it seems that it is not easy to become accustomed to a Western system of human rights. Yeah, those Western human rights. Which Western human rights? We seem largely to have given up many of them. And, granted, I think the Obama administration is working toward maybe restoring some of them and regaining some of that high ground that George W. Bush and Darth W. Cheney, the big time Richard B., big time Dick Cheney, ran, that high ground, high human rights, they ran off it, ran. We're trying to get some of it back. But Western-style human rights aren't working in Kyrgyzstan. Because those people that thought they were going to get them some democracy since we had an air base there, they propelled Bakiyev to power in 2005 in a popular uprising. And then President Bakiyev promptly screwed down the thumbscrews real tight on anything resembling political opposition. See, you really can't have democracy without political opposition. And you have to have a commitment to the idea that we're going to work things out verbally as opposed to manually or chemically via the gas-charged explosions of gunpowder. President Bakiyev is concerned about democracy because he thinks it's been, it's been a little deleterious to Kyrgyz society, and he's very much disturbed, and wants to review the concept of individual human rights. He says individual human rights lead to selfishness and a decline in public morality. Jesus, he sounds like a Republican! Louis Gohmert? Anybody? Republican? Texas? Wants to take away the ability of the American people to vote for their U.S. senators? I think you could sit those two down to high tea and they'd get along famously. There was a protest rally planned, but near where Bakiyev was speaking about his misgivings about democracy, they were going to have a protest rally, but instead the police came and rounded up about 20 people, and, no rally. No democracy. Akshumkar, opposition party leader, that's the name of the opposition party, the name of the leader is Timur Sariyev. Timur Sariyev said the detention of his supporters was a gross violation of the Constitution. The authorities are afraid to hear the truth and learn what truly concerns normal people. Food, shelter, heat in the winter. Oh, and you're going to love this paragraph. This is the final paragraph of the news story from the Associated Press. Most Kyrgyz people rely on state-controlled broadcasters as their main source of news, but those stations have failed to cover a series of protests against rising costs for heating and electricity.